Thank you so much for the kind introduction, and thank you for having me here at this wonderful workshop. I mean, we get to the end of it, so I can already be sentimental about it. My paper kind of feels like a kind of meta paper right now, at least because I think I feel so many strings of what we discussed before running together here. So let's just start. I'll have a presentation, but that won't be very fancy. It's just basically the quotes I'm going to read to you. So, transformation is a matter of repetition. That's what I'm going to claim, and I won't claim much more than that. I'll just try to unpack that statement, or rather meditate upon it, or something like that. And I'm going to do that in two parts. There'll be some general kind of remarks I have on this subject, and then there's going to be something I'll read you examples maybe or whatever. And we can all it's maybe it's going to be something like experimental, and we can discuss everything then later on in the Q&A. So, transformation is a matter of repetition. This may seem self-contradictory at first, because transformation, on the one hand, means change, is directed to leaving an old state behind and bringing forth something new or something different at least. Repetition, on the other hand, means reproduction of something already given. It doesn't seem to be directed to change that much, or doesn't seem to be directed to change at all, but rather to generating sameness. But of course, there can never be something like an exact repetition. And this is why I think there is no contradiction. There is no contradiction, but rather something like a gap, maybe, caused by what is that? Caused by small deviations and imperfections, or just by the passing of time. That's what produces the gap between the repetitions, the single repetitions. So here's my bolder, maybe more speculative part of my claim. I would like to, well, try out on you or something like that. The link I'd like to claim between repetition and transformation is aesthetic.
Is
Aesthetic. Why would I say so? I think first, repetition plays a particular role within the field of aesthetics. It's true, I think, for aesthetic experiences on the one hand, as well as for aesthetic practices on the other hand. On the level of experience, I'd say repetition often is an expression of positive aesthetic evaluation. So we listen to a song we like multiple times over. We revisit our favorite paintings in the gallery when we get back to a city, maybe go there and pay them a visit again and again. And there's a special pleasure in a range, I think, of aesthetic phenomena that incorporate repetition, say cycles of paintings, maybe series of TV shows, think of them, genres, they include some kind of repetition, I guess, as well. And moreover, there are specific forms of repetition that kind of constitute aesthetic phenomena of their own, say cover versions of songs or remakes of movies, and variations of all kinds of themes, pastiches of paintings, stuff like that. Now, on the level of aesthetic activity, I think the connection may even be more apparent. The very word practice, I think, is wearing it on its face. So when we talk of aesthetic practices, we refer to a commonly learned and habituated set of attitudes and actions governing a particular field of activity. Think of the practice of drawing or the practice of dancing. And in order to master these practices, as we have experienced actually in this workshop, in order to master these practices, we will have to practice. So that means to repeat a set of actions, a sequence of it over and over again in order to reach a certain, say, subjective or objective level of perfection. Think of practicing to draw, or practicing to dance, or practicing to play the piano, or whatever. And I'd be inclined to think that these aesthetic experiences with artworks or with whatever, and performance and the practicing of it are two sides of one coin. But I'm not going to get deeper into this. I just claim this at this point. So, but second, this is the first thing, the first connection between repetition and the aesthetic. The second claim I'd make, so the second half of my claim is about transformation, because I think the aesthetic is tied to transformation as well. This is a more abstract level, though, but the aesthetic is, I'd say, about the moment in relation to the possibility of change. So many aesthetic theories get somehow to the point that in aesthetic circumstances, we kind of celebrate or at least experience the indeterminate or contingency or the the utopian, or like to put it really existentially now, the fact of our finitude. This is a contrast that is maybe even to be experienced in aesthetic circumstances. And this might just be the reason why concepts like eternal recurrence or bad infinity, or whatever what your philosophical inclination is to call a phenomena like that, are the exact opposite of what I'm talking about. This kind of fantasy of something that is returning over and over again and precluding change is what these people, I think, are thinking about. So, I'll kind of try to frame this now by taking a quick look at Freud's psychoanalytic take on repetition, or part of it. So on the one hand, repetition in psychoanalysis reactualizes past conflicts and unconscious motivations, which is why it is, why it constantly gets in the way of therapeutic success. Right. But on the other hand, repetition is essential to the process of analysis. It's the very means to its ends. It's this, in this sense in which its elements are, as Freud calls it, now the elements of analysis in one of his essays, Remembering, Repeating, and Working Through. So in his deep meditation about the forces of repetition in his seminal text, Beyond the Pleasure Principle, Freud gives the famous example of this, of his own observation of a 1.5-year-old boy playing what has come to be known as the Fort Dar game. So, and here's Freud's report. The child had a wooden reel. Yeah. I'll read it anyway, so Don't mind the Zoom thing there. The child had a wooden reel with a piece of string tied around it. What he did was to hold the reel by the string and very skillfully throw it over the edge of his curtain cot so that it disappeared into it. And at the same time uttering this expressive, oh, I guess it was. He then pulled the reel out of the cot again by the string and hailed its reappearance with a joyful da there. This then was the complete game, disappearance and return. I'm not at all interested in today's context and Freud's struggles with the problems of his own economic model, nor do I want to look closely into his theorizing repetition compulsion or the notorious death threat. It's not, I'm not going on about that. Let me just, I'd just like to emphasize two of the multiple functions I think he assigns to this boy's play of repetition, as you in his own report. And of course, I could think of a lot more. This is such a rich scene that you could comment upon forever, and people do so. But it is this game is a method of mastering unpleasurable experiences, so the mother is gone. And thus to shape the world according to his desires, the boy's desires, as much as it generates pleasure, I guess, in itself. An innate, as it seems, pleasure in repetition itself. And Freud is... Yeah, right, that's the quote. Kind of confirming this in the case of the children's play, Freud says... We seem to see that children repeat unpleasurable experiences for the additional reason that they can master a powerful impression far more thoroughly by being active than they could by merely experiencing it passively. Each fresh repetition seems to strengthen the mastery they are in search of. Nor can children have their pleasurable experiences repeated often enough, and they are inexorable in their insistence that the repetition be an identical. So Freud now is convinced that this aesthetic pleasure of repetition disappears at later life. Novelty, instead, will become the condition of aesthetic value, is what he claims. Here's how he goes on in this text. If a joke is heard for the second time, it produces almost no effect. A theatrical production never creates so great an impression the second time as at the first. Indeed, it is hardly possible to persuade an adult who has very much enjoyed reading a book to reread it immediately. Novelty is always the condition of enjoyment. But children will never tire of asking an adult to repeat a game that he has shown them or played with them till he is too exhausted to go. And this might well be, I thought, a father's perspective rather than a mother's perspective, but whatever. And if, it is said that Freud was a very good father for the time he lived in, but still. So, and if a child has been told a nice story, he, again, this is maybe due to the example, because he's talking about this little boy, he will insist on hearing it over and over again rather than a new one. As I've mentioned before, I don't think it's that clear cut. To be sure, I think Freud undoubtedly has it right that as a general rule, children enjoy repetition in a way quite different from adults, even to a degree that it makes it really impossible or inaccessible for us to comprehend or to participate in the same kind of repeated playing than they do. But I think he underestimates in his quick gloss, this is not a text on aesthetics, but still in this quick gloss, the multifaceted aesthetic potential of repetition. And that's part of its transformative or, say, reorganizational potential as well. Of course, I mean, repetition as such is all over the place. You don't have to frame it in psychoanalytic terms at all in order to acknowledge its significance. All learning includes imitation, and no tradition is ever conceivable without stealing from other traditions, or no culture without stealing from other cultures. And on a personal as well as on a cultural level, borrowing or taking away or stealing, or whatever you're inclined to call it, is ubiquitous. And I think there is no praxis or not even basic action without repetition, routine, automatism, or those kinds of things. But I am inclined to think that from the little kid's mimetic play, there is a direct line to all kinds of basic or sophisticated aesthetic practices. In fact, I do think that we are already in the vicinity of aesthetic of repetition as an aesthetic practice. And there are all kinds of concepts that relate to this. Think of imitation or mimesis or appropriation, remake, variation, etc., etc. You can come up with whatever example you are thinking. And on this note, I'll come to the second part of my talk. And I'm going to linger on these phenomena of repetition. As Johannes said, I'm working with Alvar Noé, and he would, especially lately, maybe say something like, all theory or all philosophy is in itself something like an aesthetic practice. And me, I mean, the things we talk about very often is that I am interested in all these intersections between theory, fiction, and kind of autobiographic thinking. My example from Freud was already pointed in that direction, because that is being a very personal observation. It's not just any old boy, it was his own beloved grandson he observed playing this game, and his mother, so Freud's daughter, later died, and they have been very close. They even lived together. And so this was a very personal, even if only subliminal, but a very personal experience. So I'm interested in this kind of stuff. And I'm interested in, and I'm going to present you today to narratives of transformation as examples. Transformations, especially in both cases regarding gender, or gender and class. So my first example is here. This is media theorist Mackenzie Walk's wonderful book, Reverse Cowgirl. And as you can see already in the title, it's about sex on the one hand, it's about gender, it's about like different experiences at different times of their gender and their sex, and it's about a gender transformation in the end. So in this book, she frequently refers to David Bowie as a kind of emblem or a simile of her own experience of the world. Not only while recalling moments in life accompanied by his music or performances or concerts or whatever, but also as a figure embodying exactly the connection or tension between repetition and transformation I'd like to emphasize. And here's a quote from a kind of very intimate passage in the book in which Walk directly addresses Bowie. So she talks to him in this passage, to him or to his persona or whatever. Here's a quote. She says, "You were the substitute. You looked pretty tall, but you were high and your heels were platforms. You were the double, the copy of those original great white English rock stars, already copies of the white American copies of the blues. Maybe you stole less from black art because you shoplifted the discarded remnants of it from the op shops of the culture industry. You weren't just one copy, a remainder, a nicked original. You were the tactics of copying itself. What is authentic in the copy can't be the copy, it's the copying. And so you copied over and over variations, showing how a look and a sound and a mood can be put together out of information." So here, repetition, or copying, as Walk calls it, appears as a strategy not only of creativity, but also of a kind of queer critique. What brings authenticity, as Walk calls it, into the unrestrained, as it seems, appropriation of cultural practices and styles is the fact that there has always been and always will be a further step of repetition, of copying, of quotation between whatever can be understood as an original, and it's not that easy to pinpoint, as you can see here, and its variation, and in this case, Bowie's music and style. Moreover, the repeated variation turns our attention to the procedure, to the practice of copying itself. It does so in some kind of critical way, actually, in that it makes repetition visible in the first place, as a process of generating something original, something of its own. And so Bowie's virtuoso practice of repeated recycling generates an aesthetic surplus, transcending the contents of what is copied. You could call this model of conscious and transformative copying I brought into play here something like critical appropriation or appropriation in general. Sometimes transport, especially in art, transports this kind of idea. So I mean appropriation as an aesthetic strategy which has to do, in my view, with the interplay of object and criticism, and maybe even with the interplay of criticism and critique. So this is why, from an investigation into aesthetic practices of repetition and appropriation, like in this kind of example, we can see something, or can learn something about the connection between aesthetics, critique, and transformation. And there's further examples you could name, say, Homi Bhabha's concept of mimicry, for example, where colonialized people take on the habits and styles of the colonists in order to transform them or take an ironic position towards them. Or think of the end of Judith Butler's Gender Trouble, where there's these kinds of subversive bodily acts, as she calls it, and stuff like that. They all have to do with taking something on, all these kinds of gay and queer critiques of derogatory expressions, or the taking on of these words like queer or gay or the N-word or whatever, and turn them into some kind of critique. So do I have I got a couple of minutes left?
Yeah.
Then I'll have a second example for you. It's not gonna be that much I'm gonna say about this one. This is Edouard Louis' like latest novel, and I just checked it's going to come out and finish just next week or in 2 weeks' time. There is no English translation yet. It's going to come out later. There is a German one. And I'm going to be quoting now a little from the French original. Here's a cover of the Finnish version. There's a Swedish one already. Right. It's going to be translated in the next couple of weeks, I guess, into all kinds of languages because of this kind of superstar he is now. So, but the questions I'd like to ask with him, what does it mean to be oneself or to be a self? And what does it mean to become another or another self? What does it mean to leave your class? That's what he's going on about, obviously. Or gender, and choose another one or choose none. So he has Edouard Louis, you might be familiar with his work already. He's kind of developed a literary practice of reporting and recounting autobiography that revolves exactly around these kinds of questions, you know, kind of blend between sociology and literature. So as I said, it'll be out. Finish. I'll keep this cover posted here. So maybe he's kind of claim is, if there's something like that in literature at all, is that I am becoming the one I am because of my past on the one hand, where I come from, but so, and then because of all the differences in class and wealth and upbringing I am born into. But on the other hand, though, I'm becoming the one I am along my own idea of who I want to be. So it's both. And Louis, in his method of writing, takes both aspects to an extreme in some kind of way. Very rigorously, he describes the precarious and desperate situation he and his working class family of origin lived in his childhood in the north of France. And this, there's a kind of extreme or even brutal realism, but that is contrasted by a kind of you could almost say hyperactive will to transformation. And that's even reflected in a kind of breathless, in the kind of breathless writing style he has. So Edouard, the literary figure, desperately longs to change his life, and accordingly, the person he is, following an idea of radical negation in the first instance of his destiny, or what's the way he's tracked. He'll work manically. I'm giving you a kind of a synopsis of what happens there. He'll work manically in order to achieve everything which, as a matter of course, is inaccessible for people of his background. Then in the end, he will have been inside, in the end of this particular narrative, he will have been inside the most wealthy and sophisticated circles in Paris. He will have visited the finest restaurants. He will have been to operas and soirees and whatever there is. He will have traveled places all over the world. But now my point is, and this is something he's describing, the transformations and even the bodily transformations he's going through in the course of that narrative have to do basically with practicing and repetition. I've got some quotes for you now. It's only two or three. And as I said, because there's no English transformation, I made one for you. Excuse my incapacities in that, but I give you the French original. So, my body told a different story than the one I wanted to fashion by my intention. It wasn't enough to know names of novelists or to go to the movies with Nadia and Elena, to transform the subjects of my conversations in order to become somebody else. So I practiced. Every day I practiced to pronounce the words without accent. I repeated the words. While walking in the street, at night before I went to sleep, I struggled to control the movements and the contractions of my lips, of my tongue, of my throat, when I spoke to Nadia and Elena. These are two figures that play a huge role in the narrative. I had to keep my concentration in order not to flinch. So here's a second passage. Now, when it came to the way I laughed. I did the same thing as I did in the case of the accent. I practiced. I had decided to learn a new way of laughing by way of intention. I placed myself in front of a mirror, and day after day I practiced to laugh differently, less loudly, my mouth less wide opened, less expressively. So, but now, maybe even the most also, is that one interesting fact to me, even the most interesting maybe, is that this novel, Changer Méthode, it can be read in some kind of way. So if you're familiar with Louis' work, you will know all this, right? You will have read it before, and you can read it as a retelling of the same story he told before in past novels, or at least once before. Then the method in the title of the book, Changer Méthode, is not only the method of practice he uses to change himself, but is a method of is his method of writing as well. The method not only refers to his own methodical transformation of a mind and a body, but it also refers to the almost therapeutic method of repeated recounting that gives the novel its very form. So it's its own version of Freud's slogan of remembering, repeating, and working through that happens here, blurring the distinction somehow between reconstruction and construction. And here's one last passage from the novel that kind of, I guess, picks up exactly this theme. He says, and in this book, as in the case of Walk's book, he's constantly addressing someone. He's addressing his old friends Nadia and Elena that came up in the quote before, but in this case he's directly addressing his father. But I think at the same time, he's addressing the reader as well. Do I have to tell you the beginning of his story once more? I've grown up in a world that rejected everything I was, and I experienced it as an injustice because that's what I repeated to myself hundreds of times a day, right to the point of loathing. I experienced it as an injustice because I hadn't chosen what I was. Now, I've already told it, but I have to take it up again. I've promised myself to do it. And there's this insistence that lies in the repetition here that I'd like to highlight, and the way that Louis almost aggressively open about or manically open about himself. But then on the other hand, and that's kind of the last words I'm going to say, is he returns in his narrative, he constantly returns to kind of a feeling of regret he might have for having done what he said for his transformation. And in the way he's open with all this kind of descriptions of how he practices change, he's in a similar way open to the personal cost of his transformation and to what he left behind, and about the ongoing drive to continually, if you once you started, to flee and change all over again. And that might point back to the darker sides of compulsion that are hidden in Freud's text as well. Thank you.